There are quite a few places right now that, like Dan Siegel is one of the people that's pushing this mindfulness in the schools, where they train teachers how to teach children how to do like deep breathing and visualization and, you know, a lot of the yoga techniques that help children regulate. And they've been very successful. So you might, you know, take a few minutes at the beginning of a class and let's just breathe through our nose and out through our mouth 10 times. And, you know, you don't have to proselytize about the fact that yoga.
Right. Well, and that's a good tool for all of the children to have.
It is. There's nothing that a teacher is going to do for a child that's had a trauma history that will not benefit typical kids as well. And I think that's one of the things that the word trauma is kind of scary. It sounds like huge. It sounds like it belongs in a hospital as opposed to a school. But in fact, what you're trying to do is give children access to what typical kids get from birth, which is good parenting, which is an objective other who is available to help them learn how to take care of themselves.
Right.
And so nothing that you do for those children is going to in any way harm typical kids.
Right. Exactly.
You know, one of the things that early childhood people always stress in terms of child development and cognition is the role the play has in developing the brain. And I think it's a good thing to think of cognitive development in schools in a playful manner as well. Play teaches a lot of self-regulation skills. It teaches me how to kind of practice in my mind what I'm going to say. It teaches me how to take the role of somebody else and see how that feels. A lot of areas of cognition that are deficient in children that have been, you know, in environments that have been neglectful or abusive in some ways.
Right, right. So if I'm a teacher listening to this, and I hope there are lots of teachers listening to this because there's such valuable information here, I'm probably thinking to myself that, you know, that with the Common Core curriculum and all of the things that I am required to do to teach and cover in the classroom and all the demands on my time and resources, that even implementing some of the things that you've suggested might seem overwhelming, and it just seems like this is something more I've got to learn. How would you address that with teachers?
Well, that actually comes up with teachers all the time because, of course, they feel overwhelmed with all the things that kind of get thrown their way in terms of practices. And what I say to teachers is it's not really about what you have to teach in terms of trauma-sensitive techniques. It's how you teach it. And so think a lot about take your Common Core, take the standards that people are saying need to be taught, and then think about how you're going to present that information in a way that is conveying to children a sense of safety, a sense of purpose, a predictability. Structure lessons so that there is a lot of opportunity for peer collaboration. Think about the conversational tone in the classroom, the use of children's names, things that all of us have learned as teachers to be best practices, like anything that Carol Ann Tomlinson has written, I would say you could use as a trauma-sensitive approach, and that she's the woman that's done so much with differentiated instruction, giving children choices, teaching children to reflect on what they've done and decide what parts they like about what they've done and what they've changed if they had an opportunity to do it again, because really what teaching does that I don't think any other helping profession can do is it works with the prefrontal cortex, which is the last part of the brain to develop, teach children how to regulate and how to set goals and how to overcome the dysregulation they've experienced in early childhood. It's like nature's second chance, that if you've had a hard start and you've had parents that didn't really perhaps know how to provide the best environment for you when you were young. The fact that the prefrontal cortex does not develop until the 20s, it's not fully mature until the 20s, and that it's so responsive to good instruction. It's responsive to, you know, good questions. It's responsive to knowing how to teach so that you get children to make inferences. That's how you grow a prefrontal cortex. And I just think that teachers have an incredible opportunity to help correct so many of the things that have gone wrong for children by following the best practices of their own profession. They don't need to be social workers. They don't need to be psychologists. They just need to know what is the best practices currently being recommended for teachers for my profession.
Mm-hmm.
And how am I going to ensure that I provide that in my classroom as consistently as possible? There's a lot of hope. The plasticity of the brain offers incredible hope for children that have had hard starts, and we just need to work with it as opposed to pretending it's not there. I always tell teachers that they're in the business of growing children's brains. That's
mm-hmm.
really what they do, because the brain is socially constructed. And anybody that you ask as an adult, if they had a very difficult childhood, if you ask them, well, what saved you, what helped, and they'll always say a teacher.
A teacher. And
always
that's
a teacher.
So
mm-hmm. I mean, so we can't devalue what teachers do. And I might just add there that one of the things that I've been reading recently is that in terms of language in classrooms, I remember in the old days, teachers used to be evaluated on the language they used in classrooms. I don't think they are anymore. But we now know that in infancy and early childhood that the parents' language pragmatics, not just the words they use, but their tone of voice, their eye gaze, their smile, their facial expression, the tone
mm-hmm.
of their voice, all of that is encoded in the right hemisphere. So children who have had hard starts are going to be hypersensitive to a teacher whose face shows no emotion, or to a tone of voice that sounds harsh or critical.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also going to be very sensitive to indications on the face. And I would say teachers say this to kids, look at my face. My face is telling you I love you. Look at my face.
Mm-hmm.
And eye gaze, that kind of thing that is just so important to have a child feel like they're seen and that they have a place that's safe.
Right, right. And that is so important, because our children, and you talked about them having cognition problems and misreading cues and things, and they will always, or at least in my experience, they will always misread that to the negative. So a neutral face is often seen as negative to our
yes.
kids.
And the research shows that children who have early trauma histories will see a negativity in a neutral face, both of a peer and an adult.
Mm-hmm. And then they'll apply that misread into what, you know, what their actions are, and just sort of feed that negative spiral in themselves.
That's right. In terms of, I'd like to, if I have a few more minutes about the core
sure.
curriculum,
mm-hmm.
one of the things that I think is best practice that helps children with trauma histories with their peers, because they tend to be children that have fairly poor peer relations. Peers see them as either odd and a little scary,
mm-hmm.
or they just don't have the social, they don't have a lot of representational thought. Like, they can't really see what something looks like from somebody else's point of view.
Right.
So I know that one of the things that many of the standards, especially in social studies and reading, talk a lot about now is perspective taking. Like, and there'll be standards that recommend that, you know, you write a speech from the perspective of all these different people in history, or
mm-hmm.
you tell an event, anything like that that is definitely hardcore academic, but that fosters that sense of representational thought and empathy will go a huge way in helping these children develop the social competencies that they need as well as the academic ones. So I would just recommend that teachers be very aware of that and the standards that, yeah, I have to teach perspective taking, but when I'm teaching it, I'm going to be really keen on the idea that it's training not just about something in history, but it's also training to empathy. And children who have been traumatized don't like open-ended play acting, but they love play acting that has like two sides that they already know what both people are going to say,
mm-hmm.
because they know the containment of the conversation, they know where it's going to go. And so that's another good way of training them to get the most out of academic instruction is role-playing and drama.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking that myself, that a drama, a scripted something would be useful for,
very useful
for that situation.
Though. Right. Children that have been traumatized respond far better to visuals than they do to words.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
if procedures that you want children to follow in their classroom, you should always have like a written protocol for it. So if it's how to set up a paper, how to do your homework, how to line up for lunch, have some kind of a written protocol.
Mm-hmm.
Or even use what those of us in special ed know kind of as a Bible, the Mary Johnson picture symbols.
Right, right, pictures.
Which are really helpful. And sometimes people think, well, after second or third grade, people aren't going to be interested in that. I've seen high school teachers use those very effectively to just organize the room and to have all of the day-to-day things that people need to know in order to get business done there.
Mm-hmm.
Done.
Mm-hmm.
I would really recommend working hard with, like, the teacher's model where you do, like, 10 to 15 minutes of direct instruction and then you give kids something to do in group, and it can be small groups, it can be two, but that pacing of 15 minutes direct instruction, 15 to 20 minutes collaboration with peers is a very effective way. I mean, it's effective for all children. It's recommended. It's the teacher's college model. But
mm-hmm.
it's really helpful for children who have been have early trauma histories because it's very hard for them not to have their attention wander if they're listening to something for longer than 10 or 15 minutes. They just won't, they won't be there anymore. They'll be creating
right.
a distraction.
Right. Right.
Another thing that I haven't mentioned that does come up a lot when I'm working with teachers directly is classrooms that are really silent are terrifying classrooms for children with abuse histories.
Mm-hmm.
People look at me when I say that and they're like, what? But when things are too quiet, they're waiting for the other shoe to fall. So they do much better in an environment where there's a lot of opportunity for peer activity, for talking and working through problems with the kid next to you. They do not do well with prolonged periods of silent work at desks.
Right.
Great tip.
Anything that's new and different in the classroom, these kids respond really well to rehearsal strategies. So if you're going to go to an assembly for the first time, talk through the assembly, what it's going to be like, who's going to be there, who they might see. Don't assume that any of the social routines that you expect children of a certain age to have, that they will have mastered.
Right.
Environments are very frightening to them.
Right. Right.